referendum for March 17th so that the white people of South Africa could vote on his reform policy and on negotiations with the ANC. He stated that if the referendum was defeated, he would resign from office. The referendum asked a plain and direct question of all white voters over the age of 18. Do you support the continuation of the reform process which the state president began on 2 February 1990, which is aimed at a new constitution through negotiation? The ANC opposed the referendum on the principle that it was a vote that excluded all non-whites. At the same time, we were realistic. We certainly did not want white voters to rebuff Mr. de Klerk's efforts to pursue negotiations. Though we disdained the election on principle, we urged whites to vote yes. We saw such a vote as a signal of support for negotiations, not necessarily for de Klerk. We watched Mr. de Klerk's campaign with interest and some consternation. He and the National Party conducted a sophisticated, expensive, American-style political campaign, accompanied by extensive newspaper and television advertisements, bumper stickers, and colorful rallies. We saw this as a dress rehearsal for the campaign Mr. de Klerk would wage against us. In the end, 69% of the white voters supported negotiations, giving de Klerk a great victory. He felt vindicated. I think the margin even swelled his head a bit. His hand was strengthened, and as a result, the nationalists toughened their negotiating positions. This was a dangerous strategy. Chapter 109. On April 13, 1992, at a press conference in Johannesburg, flanked by my two oldest friends and comrades, Walter and Oliver, I announced my separation from my wife. The situation had grown so difficult that I felt that it was in the best interests of all concerned, the ANC, the family, and Winnie, that we part. Although I discussed the matter with the ANC, the separation itself was made for personal reasons. I read the following statement. The relationship between myself and my wife, Comrade Nomzamo Winnie Mandela, has become the subject of much media speculation. I am issuing this statement to clarify the position and in the hope that it will bring an end to further conjecture. Comrade Nomzamo and myself contracted our marriage at a critical time in the struggle for liberation in our country. Owing to the pressures of our shared commitment to the ANC and the struggle to end apartheid, we were unable to enjoy a normal family life. Despite these pressures, our love for each other and our devotion to our marriage grew and intensified. During the 2 decades I spent on Robben Island, she was an indispensable pillar of support and comfort to myself personally. Comrade Nomzamo accepted the onerous burden of raising our children on her own. She endured the persecutions heaped upon her by the government with exemplary fortitude and never wavered from her commitment to the freedom struggle. Her tenacity reinforced my personal respect, love, and growing affection. It also attracted the admiration of the world at large. My love for her remains undiminished. However, in view of the tensions that have arisen owing to differences between ourselves on a number of issues in recent months, we have mutually agreed that a separation would be best for each of us. My action was not prompted by the current allegations being made against her in the media. Comrade Nomzamo has and can continue to rely on my unstinting support during these trying moments in her life. I shall personally never regret the life Comrade Nomzamo and I tried to share together. Circumstances beyond our control, however, dictated it should be otherwise. I part from my wife with no recriminations. I embrace her with all the love and affection I have nursed for her inside and outside prison from the moment I first met her. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you will appreciate the pain I have gone through. Perhaps I was blinded to certain things because of the pain I felt for not being able to fulfill my role as a husband to my wife and a father to my children. But just as I am convinced that my wife's life while I was in prison was more difficult than mine, my own return was also more difficult for her than it was for me. She married a man who soon left her. That man became a myth, and then that myth returned home and proved to be just a man after all. As I later said at my daughter Zinzi's wedding, it seems to be the destiny of freedom fighters to have unstable personal lives. When your life is the struggle, as mine was, there is little room left for family. That has always been my greatest regret, and the most painful aspect of the choice I made. We watched our children growing without our guidance, I said at the wedding. And when we did come out of prison, my children said, we thought we had a father and one day he'd come back. But to our dismay, our father came back and he left us alone because he has now become the father of the nation. To be the father of a nation is a great honor, but to be the father of a family is a greater joy. But it was a joy I had far too little of. Chapter 110. In May of 1992, after a four-month interruption, the multi-party conference held its second plenary session at the World Trade Center. Known as CODESA 2, the talks had been prepared by secret meetings between negotiators from both the ANC and the government, as well as talks between the ANC and other parties. These meetings culminated in a final session between me and Mr. de Klerk the day before the opening of CODESA 2, the first time the two of us had met since before CODESA 1. Only days before CODESA 2 was to begin, the government was hit by two scandals. The first involved the revelation of massive corruption and bribery at the Department of Development Aid, which was responsible for improving black life in the homelands, and the second was the implication of high government security officials in the 1984 murder of four UDF activists, the best known of whom was Matthew Goniwe. These revelations were added to the recent evidence implicating the police in murders in Natal and suspicions that the Department of Military Intelligence was conducting covert operations against the ANC. These two scandals coming together undermined the credibility of the government and strengthened our hand. Over the previous months, the government had made numerous proposals that fell by the wayside. Most of them, like the idea of a rotating presidency, sought to preserve their power. But through negotiations over the past months, the ANC and government teams had put together a tentative agreement involving a two-stage transitional period to a fully democratic South Africa. In the first stage, a multi-party transitional executive council would be appointed from the CODESA delegations to function as a temporary government in order to level the playing field for all parties and create an interim constitution. In the second stage, general elections would be held for a constituent assembly and legislature in which all political parties winning 5% or more of the vote would participate in the cabinet. Half the members of the assembly would be elected on a national basis and half on a regional one, and the assembly would be empowered both to write a new constitution and to pass legislation. An independent commission would preside over the election and make sure it was free and fair. Yet there were many matters on which the ANC and the government could not reach agreement, such as the percentage of voting necessary in the assembly to decide constitutional issues and to agree on a Bill of Rights. Only days before CODESA 2, the government proposed a second body, a Senate, composed of regional representatives, as a way of ensuring a minority veto. They also proposed that before all this, CODESA 2 first agree on an interim constitution, which would take months to draw up. All of this bargaining was going on behind the scenes, and by the time CODESA 2 opened on May 15, 1992, prospects for agreement looked bleak. What we disagreed about was threatening all that we had agreed upon. Mr. de Klerk and I had not managed to find a consensus on most of the outstanding issues. The government seemed prepared to wait indefinitely. Their thinking was that the longer we waited, the more support we would lose. The convention was deadlocked at the end of the first day. At that time, the two judges presiding over the talks told Mr. de Klerk and me to meet that evening to attempt to find a compromise. We did meet that night over coffee, and though we did not find a way out of the impasse, we agreed that the negotiations must not founder. "The whole of South Africa and the world is looking at you and me," I told Mr. de Klerk. "Let us save the peace process. Let us reach some kind of agreement. Let us at least fix a date for the next round of talks." We decided that we would each speak the following day in a spirit of constructive compromise. The next afternoon, we spoke in the reverse order that we had agreed to at CODESA 1, Mr. de Klerk first and I last. In his remarks, Mr. de Klerk insisted that the National Party did not seek a minority veto, but that he did want a system of checks and balances, so that the majority would not be able to misuse its power. Although this certainly sounded to me like outright opposition to the idea of majority rule, when I spoke after Mr. de Klerk, I merely said we needed to work in a constructive manner and dispel the tensions around the negotiations. Despite our attempts to put a positive face on the matter, the convention ended the second day in a stalemate. The impasse, as I saw it, was caused by the National Party's continuing reluctance to submit their fate to the will of the majority. They simply could not cross that hurdle. Ultimately, CODESA 2 broke down on four fundamental issues. The government's insistence on an unacceptably high percentage of votes in the Assembly to approve the Constitution, essentially a backdoor veto, entrenched regional powers that would be binding on a future constitution, an undemocratic and unelected Senate that had veto power over legislation from the main chamber, and a determination to make an interim constitution negotiated by the convention into a permanent constitution. These were all difficult issues, but not insoluble ones, and I was determined not to let the deadlock at CODESA 2 subvert the negotiation process. The government and the ANC agreed to continue bilateral talks to work toward a solution. But then, other matters intruded to render this impossible. With negotiations stalled, the ANC and its allies agreed on a policy of rolling mass action, which would display to the government the extent of our support around the country and show that the people of South Africa were not prepared to wait forever for their freedom. The mass action consisted of strikes, demonstrations, and boycotts. The date chosen for the start of mass action was June 16, 1992, the anniversary of the 1976 Soweto Revolt, and the campaign was meant to culminate in a two-day national strike set for August 3rd and 4th. But before that happened, another event occurred that drove the ANC and the government even further apart. On the night of June 17, 1992, a heavily armed force of Inkatha members secretly raided the Vaal township of Boipatong and killed 46 people. Most of the dead were women and children. It was the fourth mass killing of ANC people that week. People across the country were horrified by the violence and charged the government with complicity. The police did nothing to stop the criminals and nothing to find them. No arrests were made, no investigation begun. Mr. de Klerk said nothing. I found this to be the last straw, and my patience snapped. The government was blocking the negotiations and at the same time waging a covert war against our people. Why then were we continuing to talk with them? 4 days after the murders, I addressed a crowd of 20,000 angry ANC supporters and told them I had instructed ANC Secretary General Cyril Ramaphosa to suspend direct dealings with the government. I also announced an urgent meeting of the National Executive Committee to examine our options. It was as if we had returned to the dark days of Sharpeville. I likened the behavior of the National Party to the Nazis in Germany, and publicly warned de Klerk that if he sought to impose new measures to restrict demonstrations or free expression, the ANC would launch a nationwide defiance campaign with myself as the first volunteer. At the rally, I saw signs that read, "Mandela, give us guns," and "Victory through battle, not talk." I understood such sentiments. The people were frustrated. They saw no positive results of the negotiations. They were beginning to think that the only way to overthrow apartheid was through the barrel of a gun. After Boy Patong, there were those in the NEC who said, "Why did we abandon the armed struggle? We should abandon negotiations instead. They will never advance us to our goal." I was initially sympathetic to this group of hardliners, but gradually realized that there was no alternative to the process. It was what I had been urging for so many years, and I would not turn my back on negotiations. But it was time to cool things down. Mass action in this case was a middle course between armed struggle and negotiations. The people must have an outlet for their anger and frustration, and a mass action campaign was the best way to channel those emotions. When we informed the government that we were suspending talks, we sent Mr. de Klerk a memo outlining the reasons for our withdrawal. In addition to resolving the constitutional deadlocks at CODESA 2, we demanded that the people responsible for the violence be tracked down and brought to justice, and that some mechanism be found for fencing in and policing the hostels, the seedbeds of so much violence. Mr. de Klerk sent us back a memo asking for a face-to-face meeting with me, which we rebuffed. I felt such a meeting would suggest that we had something to talk about, and at the time, we did not. The mass action campaign culminated in a general strike on August 3rd and 4th in support of the ANC's negotiation demands and in protest against state-supported violence. More than 4 million workers stayed home in what was the largest political strike in South African history. The centerpiece of the strike was a march of 100,000 people to the union buildings in Pretoria, the imposing seat of the South African government, where we held an enormous outdoor rally on the great lawn in front of the buildings. I told the crowd that we one day would occupy these buildings as the first democratically elected government of South Africa. In the face of this mass action, Mr. de Klerk said that if the ANC made the country ungovernable, the government might be forced to consider some unpleasant options. I warned Mr. de Klerk that any anti-democratic actions would have serious repercussions. It was because of such threats, I said, that it was absolutely critical to set up a transitional government. Inspired by the success of the mass action campaign, a group within the ANC decided to march on Bisho, the capital of the Siske homeland in the Eastern Cape, a Bantustan led by Brigadier Upa Gqozo. The Siske had a history of repression against the ANC, and in 1991, Brigadier Gqozo had declared a state of emergency in the Siske to curtail what he called ANC-sponsored terrorism. On the morning of September 7, 1992, 70,000 protesters set out on a march to Bisho's main stadium. When a group of marchers attempted to run through an opening in a fence and take a different path to town, the poorly trained homeland troops opened fire on the marchers and killed 29 people, wounding over 200. Now Bisho joined Boy Patong as a byword for brutality. Like the old proverb that says that the darkest hour is before the dawn, the tragedy of Bisho led to a new opening in the negotiations. I met with Mr. de Klerk in order to find common ground and avoid a repetition of another tragedy like Bisho. Our respective negotiators began meeting regularly. Both sides were making a good-faith effort to get the negotiations back on track, and on September 26th, Mr. de Klerk and I met for an official summit. On that day, Mr. de Klerk and I signed the Record of Understanding, an agreement which set the mold for all the negotiations that followed. The agreement established an independent body to review police actions, created a mechanism to fence in the hostels, and banned the display of traditional weapons at rallies. But the real importance of the Record of Understanding was that it broke the constitutional deadlock of CODESA II. The government finally agreed to accept a single elected constitutional assembly, which would adopt a new constitution and serve as a transitional legislature for the new government. All that was left to negotiate was a date for the election of the assembly and the percentage of majorities necessary for it to reach its decisions. We were now aligned on the basic framework that would take the country into a democratic future. The Record of Understanding prompted Inkatha to announce its withdrawal from all negotiations involving the government and the ANC. The agreement infuriated Chief Buthelezi, who severed relations with the NP and formed an alliance with a group of discredited homeland leaders and white right-wing parties solely concerned with obtaining an Afrikaner homeland. Chief Buthelezi called for the abolition of the Record of Understanding, the ending of CODESA, and the disbanding of Umkhonto weSizwe. Just as Joe Slovo had taken the initiative concerning the suspension of the armed struggle, he again took the lead in making another controversial proposal, a government of national unity. In October, Joe published a paper in which he wrote that negotiations with the government were not armistice talks in which we could dictate terms to a defeated enemy. It would probably take years for the ANC to control the levers of government, even after an election. An ANC government would still require much of the present civil service to run the country. Joe proposed a sunset clause, providing for a government of national unity that would include power sharing with the National Party for a fixed period of time, an amnesty for security officers, and the honoring of contracts of civil servants. Power sharing was a debased term within the ANC, considered a code phrase for the government's quest for a minority veto. But in this context, it merely meant that the National Party would be part of any popularly elected government, provided it polled enough votes. After much discussion, I supported Joe's proposal, and it was endorsed by the National Executive Committee on November 18th. The NEC agreed to support power sharing, provided the minority parties did not have a veto. In December, we began a new round of secret bilateral talks with the government. These were held over a 5-day period at a game lodge in the bush. The talks proved to be critical, for they built on the foundation established in the Record of Understanding. At this bush meeting, we agreed in principle on a 5-year government of national unity, in which all parties polling over 5% in a general election would be proportionately represented in the cabinet. After 5 years, the government of national unity would become a simple majority rule government. In February, the ANC and the government announced an agreement in principle on the 5-year government of national unity, a multi-party cabinet, and the creation of a transitional executive council. Elections would be held as early as the end of 1993. Chapter 111. I have always believed that a man should have a home within sight of the house where he was born. After being released from prison, I set about plans to build a country house for myself in Kunu. By the fall of 1993, the house was complete. It was based on the floor plan of the house I lived in at Victor Fester. People often commented on this, but the answer was simple. The Victor Fester house was the first spacious and comfortable home I ever stayed in, and I liked it very much. I was familiar with its dimensions, so at Tunu, I would not have to wander in the night looking for the kitchen. In April, I was at my house in the Transkei on a brief holiday. On the morning of April 10th, I had just gone outside to greet some members of the Transkei police rugby team when my housekeeper ran out and informed me of an urgent telephone call. She was weeping. I excused myself from the young men and learned from a colleague that Chris Honey, the Secretary General of the SACP, the former Chief of Staff of MK, and one of the most popular figures in the ANC, had been shot at point-blank range in front of his home in Boksburg, Johannesburg, a mostly white working-class suburb that Chris was seeking to integrate. Chris's death was a blow to me, personally and to the movement. He was a soldier and patriot, for whom no task was too small. He was a great hero among the youth of South Africa, a man who spoke their language and to whom they listened. If anyone could mobilize the unruly youth behind a negotiated solution, it was Chris. South Africa was now deprived of one of its greatest sons, a man who would have been invaluable in transforming the country into a new nation. The country was fragile. There were concerns that Hani's death might trigger a racial war, with the youth deciding that their hero should become a martyr for whom they would lay down their own lives. I first flew via helicopter to pay my respects to Chris's 82-year-old father in Sabalele, a tiny, dusty town in the Kofimvaba district in the Transkei, a place well known to me because it was the home region of the Matanzima family. As I arrived in this village with no running water or electricity, I marveled at how this poor and tiny village could produce a man like Chris Honey, a man who stirred the entire nation with his passion and ability. His concern for the rural poor came from his childhood in Sabalele, for his roots were deep and true, and he never lost them. Chris's father spoke eloquently of the pain of losing a son, but with satisfaction that he had died in the struggle. Upon my return to Johannesburg, I learned that the police had arrested a member of the militant right-wing Afrikaner Weerstandsbeweging, AWB, a Polish immigrant to South Africa who had been captured after a courageous Afrikaner woman had phoned the police with the killer's license plate number. The murder was an act of mad desperation, an attempt to derail the negotiations process. I was asked to speak on the SABC that night to address the nation. In this instance, it was the ANC, not the government, that sought to calm the nation. I said that the process of peace and negotiations could not be halted. With all the authority at my command, I said, I appeal to all our people to remain calm and to honor the memory of Chris Honey by remaining a disciplined force for peace. Tonight I am reaching out to every single South African, black and white, from the very depths of my being. A white man, full of prejudice and hate, came to our country and committed a deed so foul that our whole nation now teeters on the brink of disaster. A white woman of Afrikaner origin risked her life so that we may know and bring to justice this assassin. Now is the time for all South Africans to stand together against those who, from any quarter, wish to destroy what Chris Honey gave his life for, the freedom of all of us. The assassination of Chris was an attempt by white supremacists to arrest the inevitable. They preferred that the country descend into civil war rather than have majority rule by peaceful means. We adopted a strategy to deal with our own constituency in the ANC. In order to forestall outbreaks of retaliatory violence, we arranged a week-long series of mass rallies and demonstrations throughout the country. This would give people a means of expressing their frustration without resorting to violence. Mr. de Klerk and I spoke privately and agreed that we would not let Honey's murder derail the negotiations. We learned within days that a member of the Conservative Party, Clive Derby Lewis, had been arrested in connection with the murder. more confirmation of a third force. It was Chris himself who had criticized a recent theft of weapons from an Air Force base. Preliminary police reports suggested that the gun that killed him had come from that stockpile. Exactly 2 weeks later, there was another significant passing. This one did not shake the nation as Chris's had, but it shook me. Oliver had not been well for a long time, but the stroke that killed him occurred suddenly and without warning. His wife Adelaide phoned me early in the morning, and I rushed to Oliver's bedside. I did not have a chance to say a proper goodbye, for he was already gone. In Plato's Allegory of the Metals, the philosopher classifies men into groups of gold, silver, and lead. Oliver was pure gold. There was gold in his intellectual brilliance, gold in his warmth and humanity, gold in his tolerance and generosity, gold in his unfailing loyalty and self-sacrifice. As much as I respected him as a leader, that is how much I loved him as a man. Though we had been apart for all the years that I was in prison, Oliver was never far from my thoughts. In many ways, even though we were separated, I kept up a lifelong conversation with him in my head. Perhaps that is why I felt so bereft when he died. I felt, as I told one colleague, like the loneliest man in the world. It was as though he had been snatched away from me, just as we had finally been reunited. When I looked at him in his casket, it was as if a part of myself had died. Though we were not yet in power, I wanted Oliver to have a state funeral. And that is what the ANC gave him. At a mass rally at a stadium in Soweto, hundreds of dignitaries from foreign governments gathered to pay their respects to the man who kept the ANC alive during its years of exile. MK troops marched in his honor, and a 21-gun salute was given at his graveside. Oliver had lived to see the prisoners released and the exiles return, but he had not lived to cast his vote in a free and democratic South Africa. That was what remained to be accomplished. Chapter 112. Although few people will remember June 3, 1933, it was a landmark in South African history. On that day, after months of negotiations at the World Trade Center, the multi-party forum voted to set a date for the country's first national, non-racial, one-person, one-vote election. April 27, 1994. For the first time in South African history, the black majority would go to the polls to elect their own leaders. The agreement was that voters would elect 400 representatives to a constituent assembly, which would both write a new constitution and serve as a parliament. After convening, the first order of business for the assembly would be to elect a president. The talks had reconvened in April. This time, the 26 parties included INCATA, the Pan-Africanist Congress, and the Conservative Party. We had been pressing the government to establish a date for months, and they had been stalling. But now the date was written in stone. A month later, in July, the multi-party forum agreed on a first draft of an interim constitution. It provided for a bicameral parliament with a 400-member national assembly elected by proportional representation from national and regional party lists and a senate elected indirectly by regional legislatures. Elections to regional legislatures would take place at the same time as national elections, and the regional bodies could draw up their own constitutions consistent with the national constitution. Chief Buthelezi wanted a constitution drawn up before the election and walked out in protest against the setting of an election date before a constitution was finalized. A second draft interim constitution in August gave greater powers to the regents, but this did not placate either Chief Buthelezi or the Conservative Party. The Conservative Party described the resolutions as hostile to Afrikaner interests. a group called the Afrikaner Volksfront, led by General Konstand Viljoen, a former chief of the South African Defence Force, was formed to unite conservative white organizations around the idea of a Volksstaat, a white homeland. Just after midnight on November 18th, an interim constitution was approved by a plenary session of the multi-party conference. The government and the ANC had cleared the remaining hurdles. The new cabinet would be composed of those winning more than 5% of the vote and would make decisions by consensus, rather than the two-thirds majority proposed by the government. National elections would not take place until 1999, so that the government of national unity would serve for 5 years. And finally, the government gave way on our insistence on a single ballot paper for the election, rather than separate ballots for national and provincial legislatures. Two ballot papers would only confuse a majority of voters, most of whom would be voting for the first time in their lives. In the period leading up to the election, a transitional executive council with members from each party would ensure the right climate for the elections. In effect, the TEC would be the government between December 22nd and the election on April 27th. An independent electoral commission with extensive powers would be responsible for the administration of the election. We were truly on the threshold of a new era. I have never cared very much for personal prizes. A man does not become a freedom fighter in the hope of winning awards. But when I was notified that I had won the 1993 Nobel Peace Prize jointly with Mr. de Klerk, I was deeply moved. The Nobel Peace Prize had a special meaning to me because of its involvement with South African history. I was the third South African since the end of the Second World War to be so honored by the Nobel Committee. Chief Albert Luthuli was awarded the prize in 1960. The second was Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who selflessly fought the evils of racism during the most terrible days of apartheid. The award was a tribute to all South Africans and especially to those who had fought in the struggle. I would accept the award on their behalf. But the Nobel Award was one I never thought about. Even during the bleakest years on Robben Island, Amnesty International would not campaign for us on the grounds that we had pursued an armed struggle, and their organization would not represent anyone who had embraced violence. It was for that reason that I assumed the Nobel Committee would never consider the man who had started Umkhonto Wesizwe for the Peace Prize. I had tremendous respect for the nations of Norway and Sweden. In the 1950s and 1960s, when we went to Western governments seeking contributions to the ANC, we were turned down flat. But in Norway and Sweden, we were greeted with open arms and given assistance and scholarships and money for legal defense and humanitarian aid for political prisoners. I used my speech in Norway not only to thank the Nobel Committee and sketch out a vision of a future South Africa that was just and equitable, but to pay tribute to my fellow laureate, Mr. F. W. de Klerk. He had the courage to admit that a terrible wrong had been done to our country and people through the imposition of the system of apartheid. He had the foresight to understand and accept that all the people of South Africa must, through negotiations and as equal participants in the process, together determine what they want to make of their future. I was often asked how could I accept the award jointly with Mr. de Klerk after I had criticized him so severely. Although I would not take back my criticisms, I could say that he had made a genuine and indispensable contribution to the peace process. I never sought to undermine Mr. de Klerk, for the practical reason that the weaker he was, the weaker the negotiations process. To make peace with an enemy, one must work with that enemy, and that enemy becomes one's partner. Although the official campaign for the National Assembly was not scheduled to begin until February 1994, we started to campaign in earnest after the new constitution was ratified. That did not give us a head start. The National Party began its campaign the day they released me from prison. Although the polls showed the AMC with a healthy margin, we never took victory for granted. I counseled everyone against over-optimism. We had all read dozens of accounts of parties favored to win who came in second. We faced an experienced, well-organized, and well-financed rival. Our campaign was under the capable leadership of Popo Molefe, Tera Lakota, and Ketso Gordon, all veteran UDF activists adept at mass mobilization. The task was a formidable one. We estimated that there would be over 20 million people going to the polls, most of them voting for the first time. Many of our voters were illiterate and were likely to be intimidated by the mere idea of voting. According to the Independent Electoral Commission, there would be 10,000 polling stations around the country. We sought to train over 100,000 people to assist with voter education. The first stage of our election effort was what was known as People's Forums. ANC candidates would travel all over the country and hold meetings in towns and villages in order to listen to the hopes and fears, the ideas and complaints of our people. The People's Forums were similar to the town meetings that candidate Bill Clinton held in America on his way to the presidency. The forums were parliaments of the people, not unlike the meetings of chiefs at the Great Place that I witnessed as a boy. I reveled in the People's Forums. I began in Natal in November and then went to the PWV area, the Northern Transvaal, and the Orange Free State. I attended as many as 3 or 4 forums in a day. The people themselves enjoyed them immensely. No one had ever come to solicit their opinion on what should be done in their own country. After incorporating the suggestions from the forums, we traveled the country delivering our message to the people. Some in the ANC wanted to make the campaign simply a liberation election and tell the people, "Vote for us because we set you free." We decided instead to offer them a vision of the South Africa we hoped to create. We wanted people to vote for the ANC not just because we had fought apartheid for 80 years, but because we were best qualified to bring about the kind of South Africa they hoped to live in. I felt that our campaign should be about the future, not the past. The ANC drafted a 150-page document known as the Reconstruction and Development Program, which outlined our plan to create jobs through public works, to build 1 million new houses with electricity and flush toilets, to extend primary health care and 10 years of free education to all South Africans, to redistribute land through a land claims court, and to end the value-added tax on basic foodstuffs. We were also committed to extensive affirmative action measures in both the private and public sectors. This document was translated into a simpler manifesto called A Better Life for All, which in turn became the ANC's campaign slogan. Just as we told the people what we would do, I felt we must also tell them what we could not do. Many people felt life would change overnight after a free and democratic election, but that would be far from the case. Often I said to crowds, "Do not expect to be driving a Mercedes the day after the election or swimming in your own backyard pool." I told our supporters, "Life will not change dramatically, except that you will have increased your self-esteem and become a citizen in your own land. You must have patience. You might have to wait 5 years for results to show." I challenged them. I did not patronize them. "If you want to continue living in poverty without clothes and food," I told them, "then go and drink in the shebeens. But if you want better things, you must work hard. We cannot do it all for you. You must do it yourselves." I told white audiences that we needed them and did not want them to leave the country. They were South Africans just like ourselves, and this was their land too. I would not mince words about the horrors of apartheid, but I said, over and over, that we should forget the past and concentrate on building a better future for all. Each rally was also designed to teach people how to vote. The ballot itself was a long, narrow piece of paper with the parties listed in descending order to the left, and then the symbol of the party and a picture of its leader to the right. Voters were to place an X in the box next to the party of their choice. I would tell audiences, "On election day, look down your ballot, and when you see the face of a young and handsome man, mark an X." Chapter 113. The road to freedom was far from smooth. Although the Transitional Executive Council began functioning in the new year, some parties opted out. Inkatha rejected participation in the election and gave itself over to the politics of resistance. King Zwelithini, supported by Chief Buthelezi, called for an autonomous and sovereign KwaZulu and discouraged everyone in his province from voting. The white right called the elections a betrayal and clamored for a Volkstaat, yet they still had not proposed where it would be located or how it would work. There was no magisterial district in all of South Africa where whites constituted a majority of residents. February 12, 1994, was the deadline for registration of all parties, and on that day, Inkatha, the Conservative Party, and the Afrikaner Volksfront failed to sign. The government of the Bophuthatswana homeland also refused to participate and resisted reincorporation into a united South Africa. I was disturbed that these important groups were choosing not to participate. To bring them on board, we proposed certain significant compromises. We agreed to the use of double ballots for provincial and national legislatures, guarantees of greater provincial powers, the renaming of Natal province as KwaZulu-Natal, and the affirmation that a principle of internal self-determination would be included in the constitution for groups sharing a common cultural and language heritage. I arranged to meet Chief Buthelezi in Durban on March 1st. "I will go down on my knees to beg those who want to drag our country into bloodshed," I told a rally before this meeting. Chief Buthelezi agreed to provisionally register for the elections in exchange for a promise to subject our differences over constitutional issues to international mediation. To this, I gladly assented. Before the final registration deadline, General Vilhorn also registered under a new party known as the Freedom Front. Though Lucas Magope, the president of Bophuthatswana, had chosen to keep his homeland out of the election, the tide of events soon altered the situation. I spoke to him on a number of occasions, urging him to let his people decide, but he would not listen. Those who wanted to participate launched mass demonstrations and strikes, which soon spread to the Bophuthatswana civil service. The radio and television networks went off the air. On the streets of Mafikeng, battles broke out between the homeland police and striking workers and students. Magope called in military help from his white right-wing allies. Soon his own forces deserted him, and he was ousted in a coup in early March. A few weeks later, Brigadier Gitkoso in the Siske capitulated and asked South Africa to take over the homeland. Violence in Natal worsened. Inkatha supporters were blocking our efforts to campaign in Natal. 15 ANC election workers were shot and hacked to death after putting up ANC posters. In March, Judge Johan Kriegler reported to me and Mr. de Klerk that because of the lack of cooperation from the KwaZulu government, free elections could not be held there without direct political intervention. To demonstrate our strength in Natal, the ANC held a mass march through the center of Durban. Then Inkatha attempted to do the same thing in Johannesburg, with dire results. On March 28th, thousands of Inkatha members, brandishing spears and knob carries, marched through Johannesburg to a rally in the center of town. At the same time, an armed Inkatha group attempted to enter Shell House, the ANC headquarters, but were repulsed by armed guards. Shots by unidentified gunmen were also fired in the city center, and altogether 53 people died. It was a grisly spectacle that made South Africa appear as if it was on the brink of internal war. Inkatha was attempting to postpone the election, but neither Mr. de Klerk nor I would budge. That day was sacrosanct. I had agreed to international mediation, and on April 13th, a delegation arrived led by Lord Carrington, the former British Foreign Secretary, and Henry Kissinger, the former American Secretary of State. But when Inkatha was informed that the election date was not subject to mediation, they refused to see the mediators, who left without talking to anyone. Now Chief Buthelezi knew the election would take place no matter what. On April 19th, barely a week before the election, Chief Buthelezi accepted the offer of a constitutional role for the Zulu monarchy and agreed to participate. 10 days before the vote, Mr. de Klerk and I held our single television debate. I had been a fair debater at Fort Hare, and in my early years in the organization, I had engaged in many impassioned debates on the platform. On Robben Island, we had honed our debating skills while we chipped away at limestone. I was confident, but the day before, we held a mock debate in which the journalist Alistair Sparks ably performed as Mr. de Klerk. Too ably, according to my campaign advisers, for they chided me for speaking too slowly and not aggressively enough. When the time came for the actual debate, however, I attacked the National Party quite firmly. I accused the National Party of fanning race hatred between coloureds and Africans in the Cape by distributing an inflammatory comic book that said the ANC's slogan was, "Kill a coloured, kill a farmer." There is no organisation in this country as divisive as the new National Party, I declared. When Mr. de Klerk criticized the ANC's plan to spend billions of dollars on housing and social programs, I scolded him, saying he was alarmed that we would have to devote so many of our resources to blacks. But as the debate was nearing an end, I felt I had been too harsh with the man who would be my partner in a government of national unity. In summation, I said, the exchanges between Mr. de Klerk and me should not obscure one important fact. I think we are a shining example to the entire world of people drawn from different racial groups who have a common loyalty, a common love, to their common country. In spite of criticism of Mr. de Klerk, I said, and then looked over at him, sir, you are one of those I rely upon. We are going to face the problem of this country together. At which point I reached over to take his hand and said, I am proud to hold your hand for us to go forward. Mr. de Klerk seemed surprised, but pleased. Chapter 114. I voted on April 27th, the second of the 4 days of voting, and I chose to vote in Natal, to show the people in that divided province that there was no danger in going to the polling stations. I voted at Olangi High School in Inanda, a green and hilly township just north of Durban, for it was there that John Dube, the first president of the ANC, was buried. This African patriot had helped found the organization in 1912, and casting my vote near his gravesite brought history full circle, for the mission he began 82 years before was about to be achieved. As I stood over his grave on a rise above the small school below, I thought not of the present, but of the past. When I walked to the voting station, my mind dwelt on the heroes who had fallen so that I might be where I was that day, the men and women who had made the ultimate sacrifice for a cause that was now finally succeeding. I thought of Oliver Tambo, and Chris Honey, and Chief Lutuli, and Bram Fischer. I thought of our great African heroes who had sacrificed so that millions of South Africans could be voting on that very day. I thought of Josiah Gumede, G.M. Naker, Dr. Abdullah Abdurrahman, Lillian Ngoyi, Helen Joseph, Youssef Dadu, Moses Kotane. I did not go into that voting station alone on April 27. I was casting my vote with all of them. Before I entered the polling station, an irreverent member of the press called out, "Mr. Mandela, who are you voting for?" I laughed. "You know," I said, "I have been agonizing over that choice all morning." I marked an X in the box next to the letters ANC, and then slipped my folded ballot paper into a simple wooden box. I had cast the first vote of my life. The images of South Africans going to the polls that day are burned in my memory. Great lines of patient people snaking through the dirt roads and streets of towns and cities. Old women who had waited half a century to cast their first vote, saying that they felt like human beings for the first time in their lives. White men and women saying they were proud to live in a free country at last. The mood of the nation during those days of voting was buoyant. The violence and bombings ceased, and it was as if we were a nation reborn. Even the logistical difficulties of the voting, misplaced ballots, pirate voting stations, and rumors of fraud in certain places, could not dim the overwhelming victory for democracy and justice. It took several days for the results to be counted. We polled 62.6% of the national vote, slightly short of the two-thirds needed had we wished to push through a final constitution without support from other parties. That percentage qualified us for 252 of 400 seats in the National Assembly. The ANC thoroughly dominated the northern and eastern Transvaal, the northwest, the Eastern Cape, and the Free State. We won 33% of the vote in the Western Cape, which was won by the National Party, which did extremely well among colored voters. We captured 32% in KwaZulu-Natal, which was won by Inkatha. In Natal, fear of violence and intimidation kept many of our voters at home. There were charges, as well, of vote fraud and vote rigging. But in the end, that did not matter. We had underestimated Inkatha's strength in KwaZulu, and they had demonstrated it on election day. Some in the ANC were disappointed that we did not cross the two-thirds threshold, but I was not one of them. In fact, I was relieved. Had we won two-thirds of the vote and been able to write a constitution unfettered by input from others, people would argue that we had created an ANC constitution, not a South African constitution. I wanted a true government of national unity. On the evening of May 2nd, Mr. de Klerk made a gracious concession speech. After more than three centuries of rule, the white minority was conceding defeat and turning over power to the black majority. That evening, the ANC was planning a victory celebration at the ballroom of the Carlton Hotel in downtown Johannesburg. I was suffering from a bad case of the flu, and my doctors ordered me to remain at home. But there was nothing that could keep me away from that party. I went on stage at about 9 o'clock and faced a crowd of happy, smiling, cheering faces. I explained to the crowd that my voice was hoarse from a cold and that my physician had advised me not to attend. "I hope that you will not disclose to him that I have violated his instructions," I told them. I congratulated Mr. de Klerk for his strong showing. I thanked all those in the ANC and the Democratic Movement who had worked so hard for so long. Mrs. Coretta Scott King, the wife of the great freedom fighter Martin Luther King Jr., was on the podium that night, and I looked over to her as I made reference to her husband's immortal words. "This is one of the most important moments in the life of our country. I stand here before you filled with deep pride and joy, pride in the ordinary, humble people of this country. You have shown such a calm, patient determination to reclaim this country as your own, and now the joy that we can loudly proclaim from the rooftops, free at last, free at last. I stand before you, humbled by your courage, with a heart full of love for all of you. I regard it as the highest honor to lead the ANC at this moment in our history. I am your servant. It is not the individuals that matter, but the collective. This is a time to heal the old wounds and build a new South Africa." From the moment the results were in and it was apparent that the ANC was to form the government, I saw my mission as one of preaching reconciliation, of binding the wounds of the country, of engendering trust and confidence. I knew that many people, particularly the minorities, whites, coloreds, and Indians, would be feeling anxious about the future,